From across the globe. From the centre of aerospace. And now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society Channel. Brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society Channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
After those warm-up acts, we now come to the star turn. Piers Sellers, born in April 1955 in Crowborough, Sussex. He received a Bachelor of Science degree in Ecological Science from the University of Edinburgh in 1976 and a doctorate in Biometeorology from Leeds University in 1981. Before joining the Astronaut Corps, Piers worked on research into how the Earth's biosphere and atmosphere interact. His work involved computer modelling of the climate system, satellite remote sensing studies, and field work using aircraft, satellites, and ground teams based in places such as Kansas, Russia, Africa, Canada, and Brazil. Now, why Kansas rates at the same scale as those great countries, I don't know, but that's what it says. Selected as an astronaut candidate by NASA in April 1996, Piers reported to the NASA Johnson Space Center in August of that year. He completed 2 years of training and evaluation and was initially assigned technical duties in the Astronaut Office Computer Support Branch, followed by service in the Astronaut Office Space Station Branch. During that time, Piers worked part-time in Moscow as a technical liaison on ISS computer software. Since then, Piers has served as a branch chief for the ISS Operations Branch of the Astronaut Office, amongst his many other duties. But above all, Piers is a veteran of three space flights. The first in STS-112 Atlantis from the 7th to the 18th of October 2002 was an International Space Station assembly mission, accomplished in 170 orbits, travelling 4.5 million miles in 10 days, 19 hours and 58 minutes. Now pay attention to these numbers. The next, STS-121 on Discovery from the 4th to the 17th of July 2006, was a return to flight mission and assembly flight to the ISS, accomplished in 12 days, 18 hours, 37 minutes and 54 seconds. His most recent flight in STS-132 Atlantis, 14th to the 26th of May of this year, was launched from the Space Kennedy Center, Florida, and docked with the ISS to deliver an integrated cargo carrier and a Russian-built mini research module. The mission was completed in 186 orbits. It traveled 4,879,978 miles in 11 days, 18 hours, 28 minutes, and 2 seconds. And that medal went precisely that same distance and time. It is the President's Travelling Medal, and my attempts to emulate that have taken to the States twice since then, and the air miles in comparison seem rather paltry. Now, for those paying attention, they'll have worked out that Piers has now logged a total of 34 days, 23 hours, 3 minutes, and 56 seconds in space, including almost 41 hours of EVA hours in 6 spacewalks. So how is he going to cover all that in the next hour or so, I really don't know. But who better could we have to deliver this 99th Wilbur and Orville Wright lecture entitled Flying in Space? Piers, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening, and thanks very much for that very detailed introduction. I wasn't aware of any of those numbers, and since I slept for at least through 25% of it, you know, probably doesn't matter. I'm going to be talking about, see if this works, flying in space. I'm going to be talking about what we've been doing over the last 10, 14 years, how we do it, how we train for it, and also a little bit about what's coming next, because I think all of you are interested to see what NASA and other people will be doing over the next decade, which may or may not be equally exciting. There's a picture of me actually yelling at my friend to pass me a wrench, and he decided to take a photo instead. It's actually the best picture of me, since you can't see my face. I'm going to be talking about the most recent shuttle mission, which went up in May this year, STS-132, and it's probably the last real assembly flight in the sequence. We took up a large Russian module and put it on station. I'll tell you how we do that. because it's pretty typical of all the assembly operations that we've done with Shuttle over the years. It's taken roughly 30 flights to assemble the space station piece by piece. So we're coming to the end of a long sequence of events, and we ended up with a complete space station, which should last for at least another 15 years. Six guys were picked for this, and here they are. You have, starting over there, Mike Good. He was a US Air Force colonel and flight test engineer. He worked on B-2 systems, navigation and weapon systems for the stealth bomber. The bald laughing guy is Garrett Reisman, 5'4", known as Big G to his friends and Micro G to his non-friends. He's a PhD from Caltech, very, very smart guy. Top middle, Tony Antonelli, F-18 strike fighter pilot and also a test pilot. Bottom middle is Hock Ham, Ken Ham, a guy who actually wrung out the problems with the last series of F-18 fighters as a test pilot, but was a strike pilot in the US Navy for most of his career. Middle on the right here is Steve Bowen, unique in the astronaut corps as the only submariner we've ever recruited. How about that? He likes living in long metal tubes and eating preserved food for months, so we thought, perfect fit for the Corps. And then there's me, climate scientist and clerical error. So, managed to get on there. Here's us under more relaxed circumstances, getting ready. This is how we'd really like to see ourselves. And these are actually the last Lycra dinner jackets of their kind on the planet. We bought them on eBay from the Philippines, and they're extremely flammable, as we found out. So we couldn't take them to space. Okay, and of course, there's the crew, usually pretty visible, which is good or not good, depending. And then a huge team of people, Mission Control and the Johnson at KSC, down at Kennedy, where they do the launches, who support the whole business. And these guys are very dedicated. I mean, really dedicated. Weekends, Christmas, you name it. They're always working and looking after every aspect of the health of the orbiter. Now, the Space Shuttle is the most complicated machine ever made, I will state as a provable fact. 3 million parts. 3 million parts. The chances of 3 million parts all working at the same time is almost infinitesimal. We're human, after all. So we have a lot of redundancy management systems. That means we have not just one computer to drive the flight control system, but four. And we have another computer on the side that runs a completely different set of software just in case the first system has a software bug in it that we have not yet discovered. Managing systems of this complexity takes a lot of time, effort, education, and dedication. And this is what these guys do day in, day out during missions. And there you can see, actually, the trajectory for launch. This is on launch day, just before we launched. You can see the trajectory. There's the line that goes up and to your right, which is the good line. That's where we want to go. And there's a couple of trajectories that show return to launch options. If we lose an engine, we have an option of coming back to Kennedy. If that doesn't work out, we have an option of landing somewhere on the East Coast or Canada, or even Fairford, or Ireland, or Africa. And there's another option of going once around the world and coming back to California. So all of this is managed real time, second by second, by this crew. Training. One of the most difficult things to train for is spacewalking. There's really nothing on Earth like it. You're floating in space, walking with your hands, trying to work, trying to think while the planet blasts by you at 5 miles per second, and you're hanging onto the bottom of a huge shining spaceship and the sun is moving across the sky, a black sky. It's a very alien environment and tough to train for, believe me. One way we do it is using the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, which you are welcome to. And here's all the guys who support it. And behind it, you can see the shape of a swimming pool. I wish I had a pointer. Okay, well, I'll get up and point. This is the shape of the swimming pool. It's 100 feet this way, 200 foot that way, and 50 foot deep. And inside there is a scale model of about half of the space station, one-to-one scale, the sister ship in the correct configuration of the ship that's actually flying. What you do is we get the retired spacesuits that we've been using on orbit, weight them appropriately, stuff a guy inside, and dump him in the water. And if you weight him just right, he won't sink, he won't float. and he can practice his spacewalks and all the tasks, including getting in and out of airlocks and all the rest of it. And that's how we train for that. Very effective training. I've done six spacewalks, and I have to testify that this was the most useful training of the lot. But almost as good is what these two guys are doing. It's Big G and Mike Good, who are training for their spacewalk on this mission. They're wearing virtual reality goggles, and you can see on their hands they've got gloves that are connected up to cables. What they're seeing is the space station and the Earth going by very realistically and in stereo for near objects, okay, for handrails and things in front of them. They're seeing it in stereo. If they lift their hand up, they see their hand. If they wiggle their fingers wiggle. And they turn their hand, and it works. If they grab a handrail, the handrail in their vision flashes to show that they've got a good hand, they've got a good grip on it, and then stops. So you know when you're grabbing things like tools or handrails in this thing. These guys do this kind of interpretive dance while they're training. They can also see their spacewalking buddy. We always do spacewalks in teams of two. So you can turn around and see your friend, and he waves his hand, and you can see it wave. It's extraordinary. This has proven to be one of the most valuable tools we have for flying in space, for training, because you can make all the mistakes you want, you can fast forward to a part of a spacewalk and really concentrate on it. It's very, very effective. Launch. Talk a bit about launch, because it's a complicated and dangerous business, and no expense spared. This is actually a very realistic hologram. No, actually, this is from the NASA gift shop, but it's pretty good. Here's a space shuttle. Weighs about 140 tons on launch. What it has in it is a payload bay, where you carry your cargo, a crew compartment at the front, where the crew sits. It's pressurized. It has two little engines on the top that you use for orbital maneuvering to give you boosts, circularize your orbit, and to fire when you want to come home to knock you out of orbit, and three enormous main engines at the back. So it's about 140 tons, and all the guys are sitting in the front. And of course, you sit just like you sit in an aeroplane, because for landing configuration, you're coming down like this and landing, so sitting like that. But on launch day, of course, you jack it up like that, so you're lying on your back in your seat, all strapped in. These guys are serviced in a hangar, called the Orbiter Processing Facility. And when they're ready, we roll them over to the vertical assembly building and put it on its tank using really good Velcro. Because NASA invented Velcro. Should know that. So there it is on its tank. So this is all oxygen at the top, the heavy, slushy stuff. So you want maximum hydraulic head to get it down. Hydrogen at the bottom. And two 17-inch diameter pipes that come out the bottom into the aft compartment of the orbiter and then feed straight into the engines. You don't carry any fuel for these main engines in the orbiter. It's all in this external tank. But loaded, this is too heavy to get off the pad. It would just sit there and thrash away. What you need to get going when it's full of fuel are two solid rocket boosters. And these are basically big firework rockets. And so on the pad, and when you wheel it out from the VAB to the pad, which you'll see in the video, the whole thing looks like this, except for a little firmer and a little bigger. So it sits on the pad. And during the countdown, you all get in about 2 hours before launch, 2.5 hours before launch. You're all in there. All the smart people leave the area. They get at least 3 miles away because this thing weighs about 2,400 tons, 2,400 tons. Big, heavy rocket. Of which 2,200 tons is fuel, propellant, explosive. So it's a small nuke in terms of the amount of energy here. So everyone retires from the scene about 3 miles away, and you're sitting there watching the clock. And as you progress towards launch, the shuttle basically sheds all its dependence on external power, data, calculation.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
After those warm-up acts, we now come to the star turn. Piers Sellers, born in April 1955 in Crowborough, Sussex. He received a Bachelor of Science degree in Ecological Science from the University of Edinburgh in 1976 and a doctorate in Biometeorology from Leeds University in 1981. Before joining the Astronaut Corps, Piers worked on research into how the Earth's biosphere and atmosphere interact. His work involved computer modelling of the climate system, satellite remote sensing studies, and field work using aircraft, satellites, and ground teams based in places such as Kansas, Russia, Africa, Canada, and Brazil. Now, why Kansas rates at the same scale as those great countries, I don't know, but that's what it says. Selected as an astronaut candidate by NASA in April 1996, Piers reported to the NASA Johnson Space Center in August of that year. He completed 2 years of training and evaluation and was initially assigned technical duties in the Astronaut Office Computer Support Branch, followed by service in the Astronaut Office Space Station Branch. During that time, Piers worked part-time in Moscow as a technical liaison on ISS computer software. Since then, Piers has served as a branch chief for the ISS Operations Branch of the Astronaut Office, amongst his many other duties. But above all, Piers is a veteran of three space flights. The first in STS-112 Atlantis from the 7th to the 18th of October 2002 was an International Space Station assembly mission, accomplished in 170 orbits, travelling 4.5 million miles in 10 days, 19 hours and 58 minutes. Now pay attention to these numbers. The next, STS-121 on Discovery from the 4th to the 17th of July 2006, was a return to flight mission and assembly flight to the ISS, accomplished in 12 days, 18 hours, 37 minutes and 54 seconds. His most recent flight in STS-132 Atlantis, 14th to the 26th of May of this year, was launched from the Space Kennedy Center, Florida, and docked with the ISS to deliver an integrated cargo carrier and a Russian-built mini research module. The mission was completed in 186 orbits. It traveled 4,879,978 miles in 11 days, 18 hours, 28 minutes, and 2 seconds. And that medal went precisely that same distance and time. It is the President's Travelling Medal, and my attempts to emulate that have taken it to the States twice since then, and the air miles in comparison seem rather paltry. Now, for those paying attention, they'll have worked out that Piers has now logged a total of 34 days, 23 hours, 3 minutes, and 56 seconds in space, including almost 41 hours of EVA hours in 6 spacewalks. So how is he going to cover all that in the next hour or so, I really don't know. But who better could we have to deliver this 99th Wilbur and Orville Wright lecture entitled Flying in Space? Piers, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening, and thanks very much for that very detailed introduction. I wasn't aware of any of those numbers, and since I slept for at least through 25% of it, you know, it probably doesn't matter. I'm going to be talking about, see if this works, flying in space. I'm going to be talking about what we've been doing over the last 10, 14 years, how we do it, how we train for it, and also a little bit about what's coming next, because I think all of you are interested to see what NASA and other people will be doing over the next decade, which may or may not be equally exciting. There's a picture of me actually yelling at my friend to pass me a wrench, and he decided to take a photo instead. It's actually the best picture of me, since you can't see my face. I'm going to be talking about the most recent shuttle mission, which went up in May this year, STS-132, and it's probably the last real assembly flight in the sequence. We took up a large Russian module and put it on station. I'll tell you how we do that, because it's pretty typical of all the assembly operations that we've done with shuttle over the years. It's taken roughly 30 flights to assemble the space station piece by piece. So we're coming to the end of a long sequence of events, and we ended up with a complete space station which should last for at least another 15 years. Six guys were picked for this, and here they are. You have, starting over there, Mike Good. He was a US Air Force colonel and flight test engineer. He worked on B-2 systems, navigation and weapon systems for the stealth bomber. The bald laughing guy is Garrett Reisman, 5'4", known as Big G to his friends and Micro G to his non-friends. He's a PhD from Caltech, very, very smart guy. Top middle, Tony Antonelli, F-18 strike fighter pilot and also a test pilot. Bottom middle is Hock Ham, Ken Ham, a guy who actually wrung out the problems with the last series of F-18 fighters as a test pilot, but was a strike pilot in the US Navy for most of his career. Middle on the right here is Steve Bowen, unique in the astronaut corps as the only submariner we've ever recruited. How about that? He likes living in long metal tubes and eating preserved food for months, so we thought, perfect fit for the corps. And then there's me, climate scientist and clerical error. So, managed to get on there. Here's us under more relaxed circumstances, getting ready. This is how we'd really like to see ourselves. And these are actually the last Lycra dinner jackets of their kind on the planet. We bought them on eBay from the Philippines, and they're extremely flammable, as we found out. So we couldn't take them to space. Okay, and of course, there's the crew, usually pretty visible, which is good or not good, depending. And then a huge team of people, Mission Control and the Johnson at KSC, down at Kennedy, where they do the launches, who support the whole business. And these guys are very dedicated. I mean, really dedicated. Weekends, Christmas, you name it. They're always working and looking after every aspect of the health of the orbiter. Now, the space shuttle is the most complicated machine ever made, I will state as a provable fact. 3 million parts. 3 million parts. The chances of 3 million parts all working at the same time is almost infinitesimal. We're human, after all. So we have a lot of redundancy management systems. That means we have not just one computer to drive the flight control system, but four. And we have another computer on the side that runs a completely different set of software just in case the first system has a software bug in it that we have not yet discovered. Managing systems of this complexity takes a lot of time, effort, education, and dedication. And this is what these guys do day in, day out during missions. And there you can see, actually, the trajectory for launch. This is on launch day, just before we launched. You can see the trajectory. There's the line that goes up and to the your right, which is the good line. That's where we want to go. And there's a couple of trajectories that show return to launch options. If we lose an engine, we have an option of coming back to Kennedy. If that doesn't work out, we have an option of landing somewhere on the East Coast or Canada, or even Fairford, or Ireland, or Africa. And there's another option of going once around the world and coming back to California. So all of this is managed real time, second by second, by this crew. Training. One of the most difficult things to train for is spacewalking. There's really nothing on Earth like it. You're floating in space, walking with your hands, trying to work, trying to think while the planet blasts by you at 5 miles per second, and you're hanging onto the bottom of a huge shining spaceship and the sun is moving across the sky, a black sky. It's a very alien environment and tough to train for, believe me. One way we do it is using the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, which you are welcome to. And here's all the guys who support it. And behind it, you can see the shape of a swimming pool. I wish I had a pointer. Okay, well, I'll get up and point. This is the shape of the swimming pool. It's 100 feet this way, 200 foot that way, and 50 foot deep. And inside there is a scale model of about half of the space station, one-to-one scale. The sister ship in the correct configuration of the ship that's actually flying. What you do is we get the retired space suits that we've been using on orbit, weight them appropriately, stuff a guy inside, and dump him in the water. And if you weight him just right, he won't sink, he won't float. And he can practice his spacewalks and all the tasks, including getting in and out of airlocks and all the rest of it. And that's how we train for that. Very effective training. I've done six spacewalks, and I have to testify that this was the most useful training of the lot. But almost as good is what these two guys are doing. It's Big G and Mike Good, who are training for their spacewalk on this mission. They're wearing virtual reality goggles, and you can see on their hands they've got gloves that are connected up to cables. What they're seeing is the space station and the Earth going by very realistically and in stereo for near objects, okay, for handrails and things in front of them. They're seeing it in stereo. If they lift their hand up, they see their hand. If they wiggle their fingers wiggle, and they turn their hand, and it works. If they grab a handrail, the handrail in their vision flashes to show that they've got a good hand, they've got a good grip on it, and then stops. So you know when you're grabbing things like tools or handrails in this thing. These guys do this kind of interpretive dance while they're training. They can also see their spacewalking buddy. We always do spacewalks in teams of two. So you can turn around and see your friend, and he waves his hand, and you can see it wave. It's extraordinary. This has proven to be one of the most valuable tools we have for flying in space, for training, because you can make all the mistakes you want. You can fast forward to a part of a spacewalk and really concentrate on it. It's very, very effective. Launch. Talk a bit about launch, because it's a complicated and dangerous business, and no expense spared. This is actually a very realistic hologram. No, this is from the NASA gift shop, but it's pretty good. Here's a space shuttle. Weighs about 140 tons on launch. What it has in it is a payload bay, where you carry your cargo, a crew compartment at the front where the crew sits. It's pressurized. It has two little engines on the top that you use for orbital maneuvering to give you boost, circularize your orbit, and to fire when you want to come home to knock you out of orbit, and three enormous main engines at the back. So it's about 140 tons, and all the guys are sitting in the front. And of course, you sit just like you sit in an aeroplane, because for landing configuration, you're coming down like this and landing, so sitting like that. But on launch day, of course, you jack it up like that, so you're lying on your back in your seat, all strapped in. These guys are serviced in a hangar, called the Orbiter Processing Facility. And when they're ready, we roll them over to the vertical assembly building and put it on its tank using really good Velcro. Because NASA invented Velcro. Should know that. So there it is on its tank. So this is all oxygen at the top, the heavy, slushy stuff. So you want maximum hydraulic head to get it down. Hydrogen at the bottom. And two 17-inch diameter pipes that come out the bottom into the aft compartment of the orbiter and then feed straight into the engines. You don't carry any fuel for these main engines in the orbiter. It's all in this external tank. But loaded, this is too heavy to get off the pad. It would just sit there and thrash away. What you need to get going when it's full of fuel are two solid rocket boosters. And these are basically big firework rockets. And so on the pad, and when you wheel it out from the VAB to the pad, which you'll see in the video, the whole thing looks like this, except for a little firmer and a little bigger. So it sits on the pad. And during the countdown, you all get in about 2 hours before launch, 2.5 hours before launch. You're all in there. All the smart people leave the area. They get at least 3 miles away, because this thing weighs about 2,400 tons. Big, heavy rocket. Of which 2,200 tons is fuel, propellant, explosive. So it's a small nuke in terms of the amount of energy here. So everyone retires from the scene about 3 miles away, and you're sitting there watching the clock. And as you progress towards launch, the shuttle basically sheds all its dependence on external power, data, calculation. It all successfully gets rid of it, starts up its auxiliary power units, goes to internal power. When the computer's happy, it fires the command at exactly the right second for when the space station is arcing forward in the orbit and it wants to go and meet it. It fires the command to start up these engines. They start, they come up to full throttle in a couple of seconds, and the whole assembly twangs this way because it's held down by the rockets here, by the solid rockets. We call that the twang. Comes over this way. When the computer is satisfied that these engines are performing properly Only then will he give the command to fire the solids. And that's because you can't turn them off. All right? You can turn these engines off, but you can't turn these ones off. So when these light, you are definitely going somewhere. And hopefully where you want to go. A split second later, commands separate the explosive bolts, the whole thing to the Mother Earth. Off you go. And it's like a kick in the backside. You go really fast. This thing does not hang around. It's a lot of thrust. Up you go. You clear the tower. And then the whole thing rolls, pivots. It's an amazing operation. You can see it from the cockpit. Turns around like this to line up with the orbital plane and then flies upside down like this along its trajectory. So the whole thing is shaking and banging away while you're sitting in your seat. It's very exciting, particularly since you can't get off during this phase in flight. But after 2 minutes, there's a huge bang. You can see the flash from the windows, and the solids come off. And you'll see that in the video. They separate off, and they fall down into the sea to be picked up and reused. You're on your back like this. Now, at this point, you're 25 miles up, 25 miles downrange over the Atlantic, and you're going at Mach 5. Which is fast. That's after 2 minutes. After a little while, after that, you roll heads up, and you go on for another 6.5 minutes, and 8.5 minutes into flight, engine shut down, and going from 3G, you go instantly from 3G being mashed in your seat and go, to weightlessness, and everything starts flying around the cockpit. And then you separate from the tank, which falls down into the Indian Ocean, a long way downrange. And then you go to space station. And all the other stuff. There's just a nice picture of some thunderstorms on the horizon. It's amazing how thin the atmosphere is from space. The thunderstorms go about a third of the way up the atmosphere that you can see. So one of the surprises to me as a physical scientist was how little atmosphere we have. It's really, you can see just about all of it above the clouds. This is what space station looked like in 2006, which was the second time I went there. It was pretty small. About 100 and something tons with one solar array, one US solar array, the big thing on the top. We actually moved that later on. But this spring, this is what it looked like. And it's pretty much its finished form. It's about 500 tons, crew of six, and it's about 350 feet from one end of the truss to the other. And these modules are, wide body jet diameter. So this is a really big habitation in space, if you like. And by the way, on the front of one of these trusses, on the front of the truss, there's a little railway line that has a bogey that moves up and down it, and that's used to transport the crane so it can access any part of station. Great stuff. And here's the shuttle coming up to meet it, flying over Scotland, as it is now. No, not really. It's flying over the Himalayas. That's a view from station. And this is the station crew, who were very happy to see us, because we brought fresh food. And then they said, oh, nice to meet you. Thunderstorm from space. At night, you can see these things. They fire each other off. You see one thunderstorm giving a lightning strike, and then you'll see a pattern of them going on for hundreds of miles, sometimes 1,000 miles. It's really spectacular. Okay, working in space. The shuttle comes up, opens its payload bay doors, and then we start taking stuff out of the shuttle and putting it on station. One of the easiest ways to do that is to have the 65-foot robot arm, and you can see the end of it there, with a little footplate on the end, stick one of the astronauts in it, and you hold on by your toe loops, reach down to payload bay, grab whatever it is you want. In this case, it's not a beach umbrella, it's a communication antenna. Then flip it over to the right part of station and bolt it on. And here's Garrett upside down, still holding his antenna. You can see the whole length of the arm there. It's a 7 degree of freedom, double jointed arm. And taking it over to Steve, who's hanging onto the boom, like a telephone pole where they're going to mount it, put it on and bolt it in place. Simple as that. And here's the two guys. You can see the back of Steve's back and Michael Good standing in a platform here. And what they're doing is changing out the batteries on the space station. We have these big solar arrays on the space station, but they only gather power on the sunlit part of the orbit. They charge up these huge batteries on the space station, on the trusses, and you use those on the dark side, so you get an average power that's about what you want. These batteries are about 400 pounds each, And here you can see Steve holding one just with one hand while he's waiting for a space to appear so he can plug it in. So we swapped out six batteries as part of the mission. This is a picture that Garrett took. It's a self-portrait. And if you look at it, you can see this is his visor. You're looking at his visor, and he pointed the camera at himself like this. So you can see the camera in his two hands there. And reflected in his station is everything that he's looking at. You can see the space station. You can see the shuttle over here. This is the nose of the shuttle, docked to the space station. And then the curve of the Earth over there. So it's a tremendous view. And it's all moving and flashing by you at 5 miles a second. And that's a view of Atlantis while Garrett was standing on the end of the arm just looking around. So he could actually see what the rest of us were doing. Dust storms over the Sahara. Huge amount of dust blowing off the deserts over the Atlantic. A lot of it ends up in Brazil, where it actually helps the nutrient balance of the rainforest, believe it or not. Aurora Borealis. On the night side, you can see this for hundreds of miles. It's all moving, and it's all below you, which is pretty interesting. It's a different perspective. The oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico kind of coincided while we were there. You can see the streaks of the heavier loads of oil going in a kind of bath plug drain pattern there. And this is about 100 to 200 miles across. It's quite a big deal. Very visible. And thunderstorms. This is near the equator. You can see the thunderstorms punching up into the stratosphere. Yes, self-portrait. See yourselves going from Penzance to Dover, avoiding the M25. You do this in less than a couple of minutes. You go very, very fast. Okay, the last thing we did, or actually the last thing I'm going to talk about in this sequence, is some business we had with the Russians. We owed them a kit to fly their module, their new module called Rasvet, or Daybreak, which we went to visit in Moscow and saw it being put together. And here it is. You can see it's about the size of a school bus, and it weighed about 8 tons. So we went to see all the guys who were working on it, including one guy who appeared to be living in it. And then they put it in the world's biggest aeroplane and flew it from Moscow over to Kennedy Space Center in Florida and landed on the runway we used to land the shuttle, which is just as well because it's a big plane. Here is the Russian team, ecstatic at the safe delivery of their module. And here it is at Kennedy Space Center, and the crew, the blue suiters, you can see there, are looking at it, and the flight directors getting our first look in the U.S. just before it got loaded on the shuttle. So we loaded it, and then it was time to move it. And we have this new thing on the station called the cupola, and it's basically a little glass bubble, six windows around and one glass window on top, hanging on the underside of the station like a belly turret. And you stick your head in there, you can see all around you. It's just wonderful view of station. And that's where you operate the robotic arm from. So it's a bit like being a tower crane operator at a building site. You can see everything, you have all your controls, you can see the guys working out there. You can even see down into the payload bay of the shuttle. And here's me and Garrett sitting in there, by the way. The world is bright and we're rather dark, but never mind. But you can see the shuttle through the windows back there, and you can actually look through the window into the payload bay. And this is the crane operator's view, my view, of the module. The Russian module is sitting in there. Now, how to get it out of there and stick it on space station? We use the same technique for just about all the modules. You use the shuttle arm, which lies down one sill of the shuttle payload bay, to pull it out and present it sticking up above the shuttle, and then you grab it with a big station arm, release the shuttle arm, and swing it over and plug it in wherever you want to go. Sounds easy. So I'll show you how it's done. There you are, lift it up, grab it with a big arm, swing it around, plug it in, make sure it's connected, and present the Russians with a bill. And there it is, just about to go in. It was wonderful. You could see it just moving over our heads as we were doing the maneuver. And here it is securely in place as we undocked. and full of food, and they're still eating it, apparently. Eating their way through it. I don't think they've got to the far wall yet. So after a hard day, you try and sleep. Sleeping space is tricky because it feels like you're floating all the time. So you watch people falling asleep, and they tend to do this. They go like this, and they go. There's a panic reaction as they're falling asleep, and they think they're falling. So the trick is to use straps to lash yourself to a bulkhead. You feel pressure on your body, and that will trick you that you're safe in bed at home, and you're not falling, and eventually you'll fall to sleep. After a while, it's time to come home. So the shuttle orbits around by itself, and then, looking at taking all the sights, you get a really good views of places you'd like to go on vacation, like the Bahamas in this case. And then it's time to come home. And the way this works is you fire these little engines on top of your flaccid shuttle, and you do this burn somewhere over the Indian Ocean. It knocks you out of orbit. Just so you're grazing the atmosphere, you fire this way, then you flip over because you're going this way. That's Kennedy over there. You're like this, you fire, flip over, and now you're ready to re-enter with a black paint tiles pointing into the wind. 40-degree angle of attack, use the atmosphere as a brake. And it gets to a couple of thousand degrees outside, and you'll see in the video through the windows how the air glows cherry red with a plasma around the shuttle. So over the Pacific, you're doing these S-turns to bleed off speed and energy. And then if everything works out right, you end up right over Kennedy Space Center at about Mach 2.5, terminal guidance. And then at Mach 1, the commander takes over and lands it. And it works great, fortunately. You land at about 250 miles an hour, 210 knots or so, on a 3-mile runway at Kennedy, and roughly 3 miles away from where you took off. It's all very convenient, and you just wheel it back into the garage and service it again. When you get out, you all hold each other up because you don't want to fall over, because your internal ear organs, your balance organs, have been completely confused by the whole business of spaceflight, and it feels like the ground is moving around. And if you're lucky, your two flight directors in the background come down to see you land, which is really nice. We worked with these people for months. Terrific people. So that's how we do that. Now I'm going to show you a video, and since you're all clued in on every aspect of spaceflight operations, you'll be able to observe and critique how this all worked. So if we could roll the video and turn down the lights, that'd be great. A couple of comments about the last bit. All the mission patches you saw flashing up there, where there are 32 missions that Atlantis has done successfully. She may have one more in her next year. But in any case, in 2011, the shuttle fleet will be retired. Sort of 30 to 35 flights per 3 surviving shuttles. And there'll be a fight among the museums about who gets them. NASA built 5 shuttles. We lost 2. 3 left to be retired next year. So was it all worthwhile? I think it was. We got a space station out of it, which will last for another 15 years, as I said. 6-person crew there, and hopefully some really good science and technology to come out of it. And I'm ready for questions, I guess, at that point.
Thank you for listening to the Named Lecture Series. Find more from this series and other events at aerosocietychannel.com. Join over 17,000 members across more than 100 countries and enjoy an excellent range of benefits. Become a member of the Royal Aeronautical Society. See www.aerosociety.com to find out which membership is right for you. This presentation was brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.